Good morning again. I want to welcome the people who are joining us who weren't here yesterday. There must be a couple, I guess. Thanks for coming. And I won't try to repeat everything I said yesterday, but we've been studying a text from Indo-Tibetan Buddhism that has to do with generating compassion and a loving heart. But it turned out that in order to practice that, we had to first slog through a lot of suffering, because it turned out that, well, our default way that we look at our lives is as we all think of ourselves as isolated, atomized individuals. And the only way that we could break out of that is to be willing to accept suffering, it turns out. Our own suffering and the suffering of others. We can't really connect to other people if we're not willing to let in their suffering. If we're protecting ourselves against the suffering of others, there's a tremendous limit to the degree to which we're able to take in the presence of another person. And I think maybe we came to understand how much that is true in our own lives, that we, without really knowing we're doing it, we hold even ourselves somewhat at bay. We don't even really feel like letting into our own hearts the suffering that we ourselves have within us, because we're afraid it's maybe too much, or we become, you know, morbid or depressed or something like that. So we try to be cheerful and try to improve the situation the best we can. But then it turns out that if we do that, the underlying self-protection that's really motivating that is limiting us in our ability to be with our own experience and to be with others. So we spent a lot of time yesterday exploring the whole issue of suffering and seeing if we could understand how it would be possible to overcome our very natural and normal resistance to suffering and be willing to actually say yes to suffering when it's present, our own as well as others. And then we were exploring the nature of suffering itself, the nature of experience, the nature of mind, and noticing how when you really look very, very closely and intimately at your own experience, it's very hard to pin it down. It's hard to see where a thought comes in your mind, where it begins and where it ends. It seems to be there. But if you try to find out, like, where does it come from, where does it arise, it's hard to do. Maybe you've noticed this. It's hard to do that. It's almost impossible. Before you even know it, there you are. But the closer you get, the more mysterious it is. And the more you realize that our human experience, which includes even the physical world that we take to be absolutely real and absolutely a given, the closer you look, the more you see that it's like a dream in some way. It's coming and going, fleeting, hard to pin down, hard to grasp a perception, even seeing something, hearing something, thinking something, feeling something. It's coming and going in some mysterious way, and in a way things are lighter than we thought they were. The closer we get, the more intimate we get, the lighter things become. So we still have problems, and we still have to take care of problems, but the extra added weight of those problems, which we completely take for granted. We don't think, oh, I have a problem, now I'm adding a whole bunch of weight to that problem that I don't need to add. We don't think of it that way. We think, oh, this is a weighty problem. this is a very weighty problem. Life and death is a very weighty problem. But maybe not. Maybe actually life and death is a problem, but not such a weighty problem. Maybe we could lighten up a bit. And this lightening up would not be an avoidance or a way of papering over, but it might be more accurate to the reality of what we're living. So that's what we were exploring yesterday. So, and that more or less covers the first two points of the 7 points of training the heart. The first point being train in the preliminaries, begin to establish a spiritual practice, get serious about your spiritual life. Remember, life is brief, suffering is inevitable, your actions and thoughts actually matter, deeply matter, so you really can't afford to fool around. So that's the first point. And the second point is develop compassion, absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta, the willingness to take in suffering and the capacity to understand the nature of mind and the nature of suffering. So that's what we were talking about yesterday. And the third point that we want to start on today is called turn all difficulties into the path. There's a saying in Zen that you appreciate more and more as you continue to practice Zen. The saying goes, the whole world is upside down. In other words, the world as it's normally lived and conceived of is pretty much the opposite of the way it actually is and the way we actually should live it. And there's a wonderful story in Zen that kind of illustrates this, where the story of one Zen master who was called the Bird's Nest Zen Master. The Bird's Nest Zen Master, because he would practice in an eagle's nest out on a limb of a tree, meditating, inside of an eagle's nest. And he became very famous for this. And because it was kind of dangerous to be sitting, out on a limb, so to speak, meditating. One false move and he falls out of the tree. It was a very tall tree and he might kill himself. So he became famous for doing this very severe, dangerous ascetic practice. So one day, this was in the Song Dynasty, I think, and one day Su Dengbo, who was a very famous, important Chinese poet and a government official, as many of the Chinese poets were, he went to visit the Bird's Nest Zen master and looked up at him and said, that is so dangerous. Why are you doing this? And the Bird's Nest Zen master looked down at Su Dengbo and said, no, this is very safe. What you're doing, that's dangerous. So, upside down. It's the opposite of the way we think of things. We think that what we should do is try as much as we can to avoid things we don't like. So let's organize our lives the best way we can to avoid the things that we don't like and eliminate all issues that seem unpleasant, and make a good situation that we will enjoy. This is the opposite of what we should be doing, because that actually is impossible. There's no way that you could organize the entire world so that things that you don't like will not arise. This is a completely this is guaranteed to lead to frustration. And we think, and conversely, the things that we like, we should gather them around us, you know, in a little pile, and we should protect them. But of course, this also doesn't work, because we can't protect against loss. It's impossible. So the ordinary way of living is to avoid the inevitable. And this just is not a good strategy, you know, for happiness. It's guaranteed to fail. So that's why, you know, the saying goes, the world is upside down. And yesterday, when we were practicing Tonglen, I don't know if you could feel this. It's hard to do, because it's the opposite of what we usually want to do. In the Tonglen practice, you're taking in all the bad stuff. And that's exactly the opposite of how we all think of things. Like, I don't want to take in the bad stuff. I want to send out the bad stuff. And then we're sending out the good stuff, right, in Tonglen. We're sending out, instead of saying, let's breathe in all the healing and get our surround ourselves with healing and all that, we're doing the opposite. We're saying, we're going to take the healing and the goodness and sending it out away from us, which is the opposite of what we want to do. So Tonglen is like opposite practice. Take in what you want to get rid of and give away what you want to keep. Right? But you can see why. So that's why it's hard to do, because it goes against the grain. But we have to go against the grain, because the grain is a very unsuccessful habit pattern deeply embedded in our living that in the end won't serve us. And I mean, usually we escape for quite a long time thinking that this is all working, but it always catches up to us, you know, in the end. And if we were to pay very close attention, we would see that it's been catching up to us every single day, but we just haven't noticed until all of a sudden the boom is lowered on us one way or the other. Either something happens to us, or maybe something inside of us cannot any longer be ignored. And that's when we realize, oh boy, something's really wrong. Something needs to be addressed. So the next logical step then is we have to train our minds, and I'll repeat, as I said yesterday, that what we're talking about here is a long-range training. We're really not talking about a bright idea that you can hear and say, that's it, I got it. Bright idea is good, and this is a bright idea. So, I mean, I'm speaking, you're understanding. That's not nothing. It's something. But it's definitely not sufficient, because there's plenty of bright ideas. And we all have a lot of bright ideas. And it's not enough to have a bright idea. We need to have a change of heart. And we need to even change it in our bodies, because our bodies are doing this. Our bodies and our thoughts and our hearts are going along in a certain way that we've been trained to, through our culture and our parents and our whole world and our own thoughts over a whole lifetime. The older you are, the more so, right? So we're talking about a training that will reverse that, that will change that. And so that does take time. We have to be realistic. And we have to make up our minds in the beginning that, well, this will take time and it will take effort. And you also can't be too terribly goal-oriented about it, because then that works against you, right? Well, how long is it going to take? How about giving some guarantees? We're talking 1 year, 2 years, 5 years? Can you give me like a guarantee? Because if it's more than 5 years, I don't think I want to do it. But 3 years, maybe. You know? So you can't think about it that way. And also, it doesn't even make sense to think about it that way, because it's not as if you go from zero to 100%. Right? you go from 0 to 1%, to 2%, to 3%. So in other words, all along the way, you see some changes. Is it enough? No. Are you now immune from human problems and anguish? No. But you do see something changing. And is it enough, and how much is enough? Well, you know, I don't know. And how long does it take? Well, you really have to be willing to say it doesn't matter how long it takes. And maybe it goes on forever. This whole life, it goes on. And past that. And then you'd have to view it not as an onerous task for a result, but as a joyful task. It's not a problem to continue with a joyful task for a long time, is it? We take delight in that. So our spiritual journey becomes really interesting after a while, and really and delightful, even when it's hard. And I think we have to have that spirit. Otherwise, you know, it's difficult. It doesn't make sense. And so, part of that is we have to change the way we view difficulties. How do we view difficulties now? Well, when something bad happens now, we say, oh no, oh no, ah, terrible, 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 terrible. And then we say, whose fault was that? And then we figure out it was her fault. It was his fault. It's this crazy state we live in. It's the crazy country and all the stupid people in the country who vote the wrong way and have the wrong ideas about things. It's human beings. How stupid and crazy they are. Or actually it's me. I'm the one who's causing all these problems for myself. I'm guilty. I deserve everything I get. Probably underneath all of our blaming of everybody else is that thought, which of course makes our difficulties 10 times worse. Because now it's bad. I have to deal with all this. I hate it. I want it to go away. It's not going away. It's still here. The more I hate it, the more it's here. And I am to blame. And now I'm mad at myself. And how could I be mad at myself? Because I am myself. What am I going to do about that? Oh, that's really a problem. How can I be myself and be mad at myself at the same time? Now I'm really in a loop. Round and round and round I go. This is not the way to deal with difficulties. But it is the way that we usually do deal with difficulties. Instead, what this point is proposing is we have to have a spirit when difficulty arises of saying, aha, so this is something tough. This is what I always knew would come. Now I have a chance to really advance my process of awakening. Now I have a chance to really challenge my wisdom and my compassion and my heart. This is a way for me to stretch my life and open it up and make it bigger and more beautiful. Won't be easy. I'll need to make a big effort. I'll need to have support and help. But, good. Okay. Not that I make this difficulty come along, you know. No, I was trying to, you know, live without difficulty. Of course I was. We all do. So we're not talking here about, like, you know, be reckless. You know, don't get home insurance. We're not talking about that. Of course, we do. We live in a normal world. Even though it's upside down, we have to cooperate to some extent with upside down world because that's where we live. So we do normal things, and we don't try to live recklessly. But this is talking about the underlying attitude of anxiety and avoidance that is ingrained in us. It's that that we want to somehow reverse and train ourselves to have a different reaction when something tough comes along. Because, you know, I don't know how many times I've heard this, people say this to me, thousands of times. Well, my spiritual practice was going really well. I was going to retreats. I was meditating at home on my own regularly. And then such and such happened. And that just threw me for a loop. And after that, I didn't go to any more retreats, and I couldn't meditate anymore, and I was just so wrapped up in this problem that it just wrecked my entire spiritual practice. I'm thinking to myself, well, wait a minute, it should be the opposite, right? It should be the opposite. That's when, because this happened, and it was so difficult and so devastating, that's when I really was practicing more. Not only on my cushion, but in my heart every minute, because I had this difficulty. There was no other way that I could cope with this other than to fully give myself to my spiritual practice. So that's what we have to do. When things get difficult, we have to make a stronger effort and really see that it's only by eating the difficulty and taking it on that we can really grow and strengthen ourselves. So that's called turning bad conditions into the path, turning bad things into opportunities. And one really great practice for doing this, and it's such a beautiful practice, but you know, this would never occur to us, you know. First of all, I should preface this by saying that we were talking yesterday about how to work with slogans and the idea of taking a phrase and bringing it into your meditation practice and repeating it to yourself and, you know, putting it on your computer screen or on your refrigerator or whatever until it's there for you all the time. Another aspect of that, or another way of looking at that, is imagine what it would be like to have a voice inside your head that was your voice, but was a wise and supportive voice for your spiritual practice. Imagine what that would be like, that there would be somebody in there talking to you, like you had your own personal Dalai Lama inside of you, using your voice to encourage you. Because we all have little voices inside of us, right? Talking to us. But are they giving us good advice? Probably not, you know. And have we like thought about that? Have we thought about like who's talking in there? And what are they saying? And how successful is this being? We have not thought about that. We have absolutely assumed that the voice that's inside of there is ourselves, and that that voice that's inside there talking is a given. And if the truth were told, we would probably have to admit that if we could kind of stand outside of ourselves and evaluate that voice, we would have to say, oh, I'm not sure I like her that much, you know? or she gives such great advice, or she's that smart. I don't think she's that smart, you know, really, that or that compassionate even, you know. I don't think she's that nice, really. You know, we might have to say that. Actually, I never thought about it, but yeah, she's not that nice. She's not that supportive. She's not that helpful. So this is really saying, can we develop another voice? Can we think about this and intentionally have a voice in us? And that's where the training part comes in, because with training and with repetition and with slogans, you develop somebody else there who's talking to you. You, but a you who has wisdom, who has a cultivated intention for the path. And that, where does that come from? It comes from repetition, it comes from meditation practice, it comes from going to retreats, it comes from listening to the teachings and contemplating them and turning them over in your own mind and examining your motivation and examining your intention. This is the whole of spiritual cultivation, but it's a part of human life, as we were saying yesterday, that's almost entirely absent from our educational system and our cultural system. So maybe we need to think about this and develop this. So imagine this voice in you saying to you when difficulty arises. Let's say something happened to you and it's somebody else's fault. Somebody did something to you and it's really had a bad impact on your life and on your state of mind. And you're full of resentment. I know this probably never happened to anybody here, but just imagine such a situation. Imagine a voice inside of you saying to yourself, so this is resentment. This is what it feels like. This is how it is in my body. I feel it in my body. These are the kinds of thoughts that come into my mind when resentment is present. At this very moment, while I'm feeling this resentment, there are probably thousands and maybe millions of other people also feeling this resentment at this moment. So may I, in feeling this resentment, somehow be a benefit to them. May my ability to withstand and work with this resentment somehow be a benefit to others. In other words, this is not just about me. This is about the resentment that people feel in this life that causes so much pain or anger or whatever it is, guilt, whatever the emotion is that's painful inside of us. If we were to notice what it was, understand what it was, understand its difficulty, and say, this is the difficulty that other people also feel, and may I, in a certain way, you know, it's true, isn't it? You know, if the resentment comes on me, in some way I'm discharging a certain amount of, like, the collective resentment. So I'm taking it on, just like I'm breathing in the suffering, right? Think about how that would change your relationship to the resentment. Because what happens when you have that kind of thing going on in your mind? Well, the voice inside of you is encouraging you to make it worse by churning it on and on and on and on and on and making it so personal and so small. That's the trouble with all these emotions, isn't it? You don't say this to yourself, but the implication is, right now I am resentful and angry. No one else in the world is resentful and angry. No one else in the world has this problem. It's all me. It's all mine. Woe is me. I am the most unfortunate person on the planet in this moment. I mean, it's ridiculous. But that is what we're feeling. That is how we look at it. Even though we don't... If we said those things to ourselves, we would immediately see how ridiculous it is. But we don't, you know. We don't say that. We just assume it as if that was the way it was. So imagine what it would be like to say to yourself, this is the resentment, this is the anger, this is the grief, if it's grief. Sometimes it's, you know, grief or loss. One of the most painful experiences that you can have as a human being. This is the loss. It's not just mine. This is what it feels like in accepting this loss into my life now. May I discharge that on myself and benefit other people by that. Looking at it that way, it's still there, the loss, the resentment, the anger, whatever it may be. But all of a sudden, now it's recontextualized into a life that's larger than your isolated, atomized self, which in the end is really the source of the pain. It's not the loss and the grief or the anger or the resentment. It's the smallness of it, the confinement of it. So there's a number of interesting slogans on this point of taking difficulties and turning them into the path. And the first one is, drive all blames into one. It's a famous one. Drive all blames into one. And that means whatever happens, don't blame anybody else. Always blame yourself. Take responsibility for it yourself. Even if it's somebody else's fault. This is not a matter of whose fault it is or anything like that. This is a matter of what's the best way to work with difficulties. So let me explain a little bit. There's another Zen story that this reminds me of. One of the beautiful practices we have in Zen, maybe some of you have experienced this, is we have a formal eating practice. We eat meals in the meditation hall as part of the meditation retreat. And so it's a ritual practice. It's ritualized every single way. You know, like there's you eat in the meditation hall. The servers come in and bow, and the serving is done formally. And there's a certain way that you place your chopsticks on the bowl, and a certain way you open the bowls. And I mean, it's the whole thing is quite detailed. And at first, you know, really maddening. When you're not used to it, you think, oh my God, these people must be crazy to create this impossible system. All I'm trying to do is eat lunch and I've got to do all this. But once you get used to it, you realize it's very beautiful. But it is a very formal, solemn ritual. So, one day, in the monastery, the abbot, he receives his soup formally in the meal, and he goes to eat his soup, and he sticks his chopsticks in, thinking he's going to pull out, you know, some vegetables. And he pulls out the head of a snake. Somehow there's a snake in his soup. You know, it's a bad thing that the abbot, of all people, to have the abbot, you know, get the snake is really bad. And so where did that snake come from? Well, you know, in our temple, the temple where I lived for many years, we had an organic farm. And people who are vegetarians eating organic food delude themselves into thinking that they're eating food without harming anything. Because it's organic food, there's no pesticides, nobody's killing the gophers or anything. They're not eating meat. They're eating food that's no harm is involved. This is not the case. Where there's farming, there's killing. You can't avoid killing. I used to work on the farm for years, and if you are plowing, no matter how you're doing it, even if you're doing it with horses, but especially when you're doing it with mechanized machinery, you're slicing up snakes in the grass, birds' nests, gophers. Even if you have no intention of doing that, you're doing that. So that's probably what happened. They were grabbing hold of some chard or something, and they cut the cropping knife, and they didn't realize it, and they cut off the head of the snake, and they weren't careful enough, and the whole thing went into the soup. Anyway, so the abbot calls in the head cook, you know, to answer for this snake in the soup. And the head cook comes up to the abbot and bows to the abbot, and the abbot holds up the snake. And the head cook grabs the snake and swallows it and leaves. Swallowing the blame. Drive all blames into one. It's maybe it wasn't the head cook's fault, right? Maybe the head cook didn't personally make the soup or take the vegetables that resulted in the snake head ending up in the soup. But he knew that it was his practice to accept responsibility, and he did. Now, this is a little tricky because we're actually, in a certain way, very good at taking all the blame. Even when we're blaming other people, in a way, we're blaming ourselves more than other people. But even if it's someone else's fault, it's our job as practitioners to see the benefit in a difficult situation. That's what it means. It's not a matter of who's at fault. In fact, the whole question of who's at fault or who's to blame is irrelevant. The meaning of this is, it is your responsibility to find an opportunity in the difficulty. Because I think what we're doing when we're blaming, in some way we're saying to ourselves, I think this is what blame amounts to, whether we're blaming ourselves or someone else. We're saying to ourselves, this didn't really happen. In other words, I do not accept fully at this moment that this happened. Never mind about this. Whose fault is it? See what I mean? We're not confronting the situation. We're setting that aside as if this didn't happen. I know, like, I've seen this happen so many times. It's so sad. It happens so often around a death. Somebody dies in the family, and it's, you know, two siblings or relatives get into blaming each other for something that happened around the circumstances of the death. If you had only done this or not done that, Mom wouldn't have died. I will never forgive you for this. And sometimes it goes on for like the rest of their lives. And that's a way of saying, I do not accept that Mom has died. I will not take that in. And so instead of taking that in, I'll misplace that emotion and I'll put it on my blaming you. And in my blaming you, forever and ever, for the rest of my life, I can avoid the growth that might come into my life if I were actually to admit that this loss and this death occurred. And so I think that's always what we're doing when we're fixated on blame. I mean, practically speaking, in the world, there may be times when it's necessary practically to assign blame for something. So I'm not obviating that, but I'm saying internally, when we obsess ourselves with blaming, whether it's blaming ourselves or someone else, in a certain way, it really doesn't matter. We are not taking in the reality. No, for whatever reason it is, this actually happened. This is now how it is. There's a snake in the soup. And now I have to do something. It doesn't really matter how that snake got there. The question is, do I take in this reality and how do I respond to it? So that's what drive all blames into one really means. And when we're blaming ourselves, the reason it doesn't make any difference to blame ourselves or somebody else is because when we're blaming ourselves, the only way you could do that is if you externalize yourself. Right? I mean, we are so used to externalizing ourselves that we don't even realize it. You can only blame yourself if you were standing next to yourself, pointing a finger at yourself and saying, you did this. Well, what's the difference if you point your finger at you, yourself, or somebody else. It actually is really the same thing. If you were not externalizing yourself, if you were actually present with the process of your living, and you weren't making up this character called me, that you were evaluating constantly, which is the source of so much human pain, isn't it? Then you couldn't blame yourself. You could only say, this happened. Now you might say, oh, I made this error. That's why this happened. Next time, I won't make that error. That's good. That's reasonable. But that's not the same as the corrosive feeling of blaming oneself and denigrating oneself. I'm a bad person. I'm the kind of person who always does this. I'm the kind of idiot who's constantly in this soup. No wonder my life is such a mess. And these are not, these qualities that I have are not like incidental qualities. They're embedded in who I am and what I am. And that's why, and so that whole train of thought, which is so commonplace for us, makes no sense and does not do anything for us. And we really have to have somebody perched on our shoulder saying, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Look at how you're thinking. It doesn't make any sense. Correct behavior. That's not successful. Good idea. Deal with conditions as they arise. Even better idea. But don't go on and on and on and on with a kind of self-talking that just makes you miserable and perpetuates these things. Why would you do that to yourself? And you know, I'll tell you a secret about how you can make that shift. It's so simple. It is so simple. Stop and pay attention to your body and your breath. That's all. I mean, it's that simple. Your grandmother probably told you that. Mm-hmm. If you're angry, stop and count to 10. Good advice. The Buddha couldn't do better than that. But the trouble is that you don't. You don't stop and count to 10. And in this case, not only counting, but also breathing and being aware of it. When you do that, you break the habit in that moment. And then you can reset. So drive all blames into one is a beautiful phrase and a beautiful slogan, which has all of this behind it. And it means, in a very visceral way, stop running away, stop using blaming others, blaming self as a way of avoiding something that actually is the case, and turn around and face it and understand that that which is always has potential. Anything, whether it's, you know, one's own terminal illness or a loss of a loved one, painful as these things actually are, and we're not talking here about eliminating the pain of what's painful, but even painful things, when they actually are the case, have the potential for deepening our hearts. That's something I think we can always assume, and we can equally assume that we ourselves are capable of making use of that which happens. Because we're human beings, we talked yesterday about the preciousness of our being human, the sacredness of it. Because we're human beings, because we have human consciousness, we all have the potential on any occasion of finding the depth and the beauty in even the most difficult of circumstances. And when we practice this slogan, drive all blames into one, what we're saying is, we take responsibility to find that in what happens, and we ourselves have confidence that with our own mind and heart, and with our training and our practice and our support from others, we can do that. We can turn something difficult into a benefit. And this is not, again, this is not about, doing this all by ourselves. Implied in all this is not only our own effort and training over time, but also the support of the teachings, of teachers, of Sangha members, of friends, of all kinds of other people in the world that are helping, that are have made lives based on the wish to help other people. We can make use of all of this. Not to mention praying to the Buddha to please help us. It's not just up to us, but certainly we're an important factor, and we are the ones who repeat to ourselves every day, drive all blames into one. We're the ones who keep that slogan close to heart. We're the ones who act on that slogan when the time comes. The next one is be grateful to everyone. That's the next slogan. Be grateful to everyone. And that's a beautiful slogan. It's interesting to ask yourself the question, how often am I grateful? How many times a day do I have the feeling of gratitude? And for most of us, I don't know about those of us sitting here in the room, but I would say that, you know, humanity as a whole, the answer is not very often. Not very often. But the truth of the matter is that every day there are thousands of opportunities to practice this slogan. Because you can't get through 5 minutes of your life without depending on others and everyone and everything. You know? You had breakfast this morning. How many here could say, I did raise the grain in my breakfast cereal, and I threshed it, and I manufactured my breakfast cereal, and I raised the cow, and I milked the cow, and I was the potter who turned the bowl that I ate it out of, and I was the metal worker who made the spoon. I don't think we can say that. I made the highway that I drove on this morning to get here, and it was my car. I made the car and the clothing that I wore driving the car, and I gave birth to myself. I had no parents. No, we couldn't get through 5 minutes of this life without absolutely depending on others, even including the air we breathe. We are absolutely in living all the time in concert with an incredibly benevolent and supportive world. Even with all the problems that we see in the world, to me, the mess that the world is in is very small potatoes compared to the fact that, I mean, why don't we all kill each other every day? I mean, we don't really. Mostly we're nice to each other. This is wonderful, you know. It is. I mean, like, why don't we drive down the street and just smash into the other car, you know? Why don't we do that? We have traffic lights, it all works really nicely. And people on the whole are quite kind. And, you know, we do have, even in places in the world that are in quite a big mess, that yes, there is starvation and there's no distribution of food in some places, but this is actually a small part of the world compared to the places where you can eat every day. And certainly we can eat every day. So in other words, it is a marvelous thing. It's amazing. It's amazing it works as well as it does. Really, when you think of all the opportunities for things to go wrong and how crazy we all are, it's amazing. So, and just one's own body. I mean, why should the eyes work every single day and you can see the sky? Why would you like assume that? With all the reasons why the eyes can break down, It's a wonderful thing. You can be grateful. When you wake up in the morning and you open your eyes, the first thing you should say is, thank God. Thank God I can see. And look at this, I got out of bed, I can stand up. Yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. But we don't think about it. Because we're thinking, oh, my life sucks, I'm not happy. Could have a better job. Spouse could be better. Not enough money. But when I mean, you know, these, I'm not talking about like abstruse philosophy. This is just, I mean, obvious things, right? Obvious things. So this slogan is to, for the purpose of reminding us of these things that are so obvious. We have reasons every single day to be enormously grateful, even if we have other reasons to be, you know, problems, because, you know, sometimes we have a disease or, you know, real deprivation. That could happen too. But even in those conditions, you know, I always say to people who are sick, I always say, well, if you're alive, what that means is there's more right with your body than wrong. When that reverses, you're dead. You know, that's the truth. That's what it. That's how you die. There's more wrong things with your body than right things. Then you're dead. As long as you're alive, even if you're on the last day and your body is quite weak, there's more life in your body than not. And so you can be grateful for just having human consciousness, be able to know that life is here in the last day of your life is worth being grateful for. So to practice this slogan is to just remind yourself of all these things that I hope, I mean, you know, this just makes sense, right? It's not a complicated philosophical point here. Or an article of faith. You know, you don't have to have faith in the reality that, yes, I think it's a good thing that I can see. Yes, I do. I agree with that. That's not like an abstruse point that I need to convince you of. If I ask you to choose between being able to see the sky or not being able to see at all, I think 100% of us will say, I would rather be able to see. I would rather be able to walk. I would rather that my digestive system would work than not. And as long as these things exist in our lives, we have something to be grateful for. And this slogan is simply to remind us to pay attention to what is the fact of our lives. And based on that gratitude, we have a different spirit and a different mind. I know Brother David, who's a wonderful person and one of the great religious figures of our time. He's a Benedictine monk, and he has a website called Gratefulness. Years ago, he wrote a book, Gratefulness is the Heart of Prayer. And it's been his lifelong practice and insight that gratitude is the heart and soul of the religious life. The religious life is all about gratitude. It promotes gratitude, it's built on gratitude, and gratitude is at the heart of it. And I think he's really right about that. If you're grateful every day for life, nothing could change your life more than cultivating that feeling and having that feeling. Nothing would be stronger for you to be able to cope with difficulty than to notice gratitude. So, this text offers you a wonderful slogan. Be grateful for everything. Remember that. Meditate on it. Bring it up every day. Train your mind in this slogan. And it also means even the things that are hard. Even the things that are hard, even the challenges. And I bet you everybody here will have a story about something that happened that you didn't want to happen, that was difficult, problematic. But as a result of that thing having happened, you met this person, or that happened, and then that led to this, and then this happened. And treasures emerged from some difficulty. Every difficulty, when it's met with gratitude and drive all blames into one, has that potential to unlock treasures. No matter how dark it may seem, that potential is there if we will take it up. So this is a whole major attitude adjustment, right? From, oh no, oh God, that happened, terrible, she did it to me, it's awful, I'll never get over this. Very different spirit and attitude. So I'll stop there with that one, and now comments or things you'd like to say about any of this? Yes?
One thing on that last point is I'm always thankful to really negative people or people who are extremely rude or impatient.
Yeah.
Because I thank them for reminding me to be more aware.
Yeah.
And, you know, like if I'm behind them in line at the coffee shop, and it's a coffee shop I go to a lot, even if it's not, you know, I know that I can kind of make a difference. You know, I'd rather be behind them than in front of them. And I just think that, like, it's so simple. You know, why would you be glad that somebody was rude to a cashier in front of you, or why would you be glad that somebody's honking a horn at you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's in Shanti Deva has an Indian Buddhist teacher from I think the 8th century has an interesting writing where he says it's thanks to people who are really difficult that we get to go deeper with our practice. They really cause us to develop qualities, spiritual qualities, and they push us to that. So we should praise them, and we should be grateful for them more than anybody else. And nice people are a dime a dozen. It's easy to find nice people. They don't do you any good at all. Because, you know, it's easy to be nice to them. It's a no-brainer, you know. But a really nasty person is hard to find, and they're like gold. You know, that's the idea. They're like gold. And if you find one, you think, oh, wonderful. Here's a nasty person who's going to really make me work hard in my practice. This person is like the biggest treasure of all. And it's true, you know. But it just goes to illustrate what I said in the beginning. It's upside down. It's the opposite of the way we look at it. And what happens to that nasty person? How did that person get so nasty to begin with? Well, they were nasty one day, and then somebody received their nastiness, and they thought, well, this nasty person, you know, I'm going to be nasty right back to them. Isn't that what we do? Yeah, I'm not going to let him or her get the best of me, so he's rude, I'm rude. So then he gets the idea, oh, this person is rude. There's a lot of rude people around here. Well, I'll be rude. And then what happens? The next person comes along and they're rude to him. And he says, you know, this is 100% of the people I've met today are rude. So I'm going to be rude. So really, I mean, nasty people have had a lifelong feedback that people in the world are nasty. They don't kind of realize that they're nasty to them because they're nasty to them, but that is what happens. And so it's actually can be quite revolutionary, as anybody who's done this knows, that such a person, when met with genuine kindness, is less nasty in that moment. And in fact, miracle healing happens when a nasty person finds someone who actually will love them with a wise and accepting love. It can roll back many lifetimes of nastiness in a hurry. So, yeah. Yes?
I appreciated your suggestion to try to find the point where we went from no thought to thought.
Yeah.
I really never watched that so carefully. And
yeah.
I thought that there were that I had quite a bit of silence in my mind.
Yeah.
Until I tried that, and I realized that at a lower level than I usually watch, there was just there were always things going on. It wasn't like something like there was silence
yeah.
and it started. It was like so much stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
What
yeah.
is this, silence. Oh my goodness.
It was yeah. Disturbed. Yeah. It is startling, and in fact, this is how our life actually is. But like you say, we only have access to a certain amount of what goes on in our lives. But I remember one day I had this very powerful experience. I was in, I guess it was Grand Central Station in New York City at rush hour, going in the wrong direction. So I was like a salmon swimming upstream, you know. And thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people were coming toward me. I don't know, like maybe in the 15 minutes that I was there, who knows how many, 50,000 people possibly, you know, went past me. And I was looking at these people, and I, you know, I was seeing, I mean, thousands of faces. And I realized that every one of those faces registered in my brain. It's in there somehow, somewhere. I had a reaction and an experience with every one of those people. Of course, I didn't, even at the time, I couldn't register it all. And certainly now, I don't remember a single one of those faces. But it's in my... So all the time, all day long, we're going through our lives, and enormous things are happening to us. Enormous things are happening. We are reacting to every breeze, every face we see, every internal memory or thought that's arising in us below the level of our awareness. Our lives are so rich and full, and we are aware of such a small part of it. So, yeah, when we drop down into our hearts and come to quiet, we can become aware of that. We can become aware of the richness of our experience and the fullness, the ways in which we're connected to one another and the ways in which the world is connected to us is almost overwhelmingly complex and beautiful. And most of it we don't know about. And the part that we do know about, as we're saying these last couple days, is often so habitual, and habitual in ways that are unsuccessful, that our lives are even more limited. So the possibility for expanding our hearts to include a richness of living and a richness of feeling, if we're willing to feel everything and anything, it's really quite remarkable. To live one day as a human being with human consciousness is an enormous thing, so much more than we realize. There's so much there. And really, I think spiritual life is a life in which we allow ourselves to feel more of that. We unlock the barriers and the gates that are slammed shut. And it's like we were talking before, that because we're frightened of being overwhelmed, because we're frightened of suffering, we close gates and we lock doors, and then we end up suffering for it without realizing we're doing it. There's so much there. And I think my experience when I try to do that practice is somehow I can never get close. The more I try to get close to the thought arising, I can never do it. And I don't think it's possible. But I remember I was doing this, David, you were at Tassajara when we were, remember the woman at Tassajara said, oh, I saw it, I got it, I was right there, yeah. And I didn't say anything, but I kind of doubted it, you know, I doubted it. I'm sure that was her experience, I'm sure she wasn't lying. But she was a pretty new meditator, and my guess is that they were, that if she looked more closely, it would be more doubtful. I think that's in general a principle, you know. The more closer you look, the more doubtful everything is. So, because, in other words, you cannot, our experience I just think that when you look really closely, our experience seems to come from nowhere, and it seems to go nowhere, and you just can't, because who would be there to catch it to begin with? So if you ever were in the room when someone just now died, you think to yourself, what happened there? I don't understand this. What just happened? It's the weirdest thing, you know. We say, oh, well, she died. The time of death? This is just for legal purposes, you know. It doesn't make any sense. It's the weirdest thing. And you feel it, this, like, there in the room, this weirdness. Well, it's always like that. It's always that weird. You know, every moment is that strange and beautiful and uncanny and miraculous and as final. And so no wonder we're frightened, right? No wonder we're frightened of actually living our lives. It's no secret, no surprise, I mean, that we would be frightened to open ourselves to all of this. But if we can overcome our fear and realize that we're living this anyway, you know, we're living it anyway, we might as well really live it. And that involves all of this that we're talking about. It involves the willingness to face what really happens in a lifetime. It involves the willingness to take on suffering. It involves the willingness to love other people. Once we take that on, with all of its, and this is not about happy face, you know. There's deep joy in being alive, and there's deep sorrow in being alive. And I, for one, cannot imagine having one without the other. I would not want that. To me, the idea that you would be joyful would be all the time. It doesn't make any sense, and it couldn't be a true joy. To me, a true joy would involve also being willing to feel sad when there are conditions for sadness. And that's not bad to feel sad or to feel loss. You want to feel, that's what we are as human beings. We feel so much, and we want to open to all that we feel. And what the whole point of this text, and the whole point of, I think, Dharma study in general, is the recognition that we have shut ourselves off from ourselves and our feeling, and our human feeling, and one another. And that isn't good for us. That makes for a crazy and unhappy life. And we really have to try our best in this lifetime. And not only, it's our destiny, I think, having human consciousness, it's our destiny to try our best to open our lives up. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. She was next, and then you, Casey. Sorry. Excuse me. Yeah.
Could you comment a bit about the process of in dealing with intense feelings, maybe after a big loss? You know, how you feel it and then step back from it and not personalize it, and move back and forth between processing.
Yeah. Is she saying, in case you didn't hear, in case of a loss, how do we work with the intense feelings and not personalize it and not, yeah. Well, I think that we all have to be humble in recognizing that when really devastating, tough things happen, it's going to be very hard. And we don't know what will happen, you know, how we'll feel, or what our heart is beating, and, you know, we our whole body is reacting. And the idea that somehow we're going to be cool, calm, and collected, and be all Buddhist and everything, and have it all together, I think is, under certain conditions, that's completely out the window. You know, and we can't help it. So, then I think we just have to practice these slogans, and in effect, say to ourselves, now I recognize that I'm really in a extreme state. And so, and sometimes one can't count on anything. You know, one's thinking ability, one's physical energy, everything could be taken from you. So you have to have enough training to, you know, really see that deep place in the mind that you were talking about, underneath everything, and I go to your body and your breathing and breathe. And basically you have to have a fierceness of saying, I will just stay here, because the mind wants to take you everywhere to avoid, right? Blaming and personalizing and anger and everything else. All those things are, all of that is, take you away. Take me away from here. So instead you have to have a kind of almost physical fierceness of saying, I will, uncomfortable as this is, I will really be here with these feelings in the body, in the breathing. I'm going to stop and just be here with it and hold on to something, literally, in the body and in the breath. And then let what's there come and go. And I think that, you know, as we go on in practice, we are quite familiar with our own stupidity. You know, and when we go on in particular ways, we say, yes, I go on in that way, but I'm not going to be convinced by that. I've done that too many times. I've seen how stupid that is too many times. That's my habit. I know that. But I'm just going to hang on. So, I mean, literally, you could hang on to a chair. I mean, I'm serious. Hang on to a chair and feel yourself hanging onto a chair and focus your energy on the feeling of hanging onto that chair and focus less energy on where your mind wants to take you, when you know that where your mind wants to take you is someplace not good. So, you know, we work with ourselves with humility, and we do the best we can. And sometimes we're unsuccessful, and the mind does take us away, and then we stop ourselves then. And we say, oh, look what I've just done, you know. And then you apologize to the person you just yelled at, or whatever you just did. And you try to come back. And, of course, you remember. You probably don't at the time. Because one of the things that is so awful about those moments is, somehow or other, again, we don't necessarily say this to ourselves, but somehow or other we think, and this is going to feel like this forever. Of course, it will not feel like this forever. It will not. It will change. It will pass. So although at the time, you know, you can't convince yourself of that, still, when you know that enough, you can hold on with that recognition. And of course, it does pass. Even the worst of things changes. And it can't stay that bad for very long. It can, if we're unwise, it can create a cascading series of events, thoughts, and actions that will continue to make more bad stuff on and on and on. That can happen. But the actual traumatic moment cannot last. And if we're skillful in just hanging on and enduring it, and not making more of it, then the healing begins soon afterward. So it's just tough, you know. I mean, it's hard. You just have to hang on. Yeah. Sorry, Casey. Yeah.
One of the slow things that you mentioned, you know, take the blame. I was raised that way, and I think that's slow.
Were you?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And when I was a child, I resisted. And when I was...
You resisted it, you say?
Resisted.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And, especially boy, girl, you know, growing up in the culture with gender differences. As I was an early adult, I, you know, see the benefit, and I it's useful in, you know, growing up.
Yeah.
But I think recently I start to wonder whether that practice also the growth for other people in the relationship with you, family, children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great point, actually. Yeah, because you could see where, I could imagine where, as a child, then it would sound like what you were being taught was, you should feel guilty about everything, it's all your fault, and it's never anybody else's fault. You want to say something? Yeah.
Can I?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. It sort of tags on very closely to something I wanted to say about that slogan. I've read commentary on that slogan,
uh-huh.
which gives it a very kind of linear and mechanistic description of karma.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, instead of blaming others, blame yourself, because it's all about what you did in a past life.
Oh, right,
and,
right.
You know, you're...
Yeah, you deserve this to happen to you now, right?
And we can very easily turn that into, well, we deserve all that.
Yeah, yeah. Can you hear what she's saying, Casey? Can you hear? Yeah, yeah.
And, in my own personal practice with this slogan, the way it has become deeply meaningful to me is that the more deeply I look into the karmic roots of my pain, it's not mine anymore. It's actually, the roots are so deep and so tangled and that the blaming that ends up dissolving into one, in a sense, canceling
mm-hmm,
out.
Mm-hmm.
Not mine, not there, there,
mm-hmm,
there.
Mm-hmm.
And which leaves only room for response, for compassion. And so it's a driving blame. I now feel that my understanding of driving all blames into one is a kind of dissolving of blame.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right.
And,
yeah.
And what you were saying about response, you know,
mm-hmm.
an open heart.
Mm-hmm.
Our humanity.
Yeah.
I was once at a presentation where a woman brought forward her questions around her mother's death from Alzheimer's. This woman had been a vibrant, wonderful person, creative, and reduced to a shell. And this woman was really struggling with why. Why? And the person who responded said, well, clearly she'd done something in her past life. And I felt that was cruel.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a cruel and doctrinaire response.
Yeah,
and I
yeah.
think this practice is actually much deeper and more, you know, what you were describing.
Yeah.
Vast.
Yeah.
Complexity. Of
yeah. Yeah, and also, I know you want to say something, David. I'll just make one quick comment that... I think that your comment, Casey, makes it clear that, and I acutely feel this, that, so now I've been talking to all of you now for a couple of days, you know, and saying things as if the things that I'm saying would all fit you like one size fits all, you know. But in fact, every one is different, and every one has a different way of structuring your own suffering and your own joy. And so, if I really were going to do this right, I would only talk to one of you at a time. And I would only be trying to, the best of my ability, give you these teachings in a way that was really made sense for you. And so I could see where, from what you said, it actually might not be a good way to approach it, to say drive all blames into one, take responsibility yourself, when sometimes, and I think that you're right, that many of these teachings do have there are gender differences, some ways in which they collude with bad tendencies in our cultures around gender. So then you have to work with them and get the essence of the meaning with them and minimize the chances for them to be misunderstood and programmed into a pre-existing mindset that would pervert what they really intend, what the teachings really intend. So I think I tried to say that this is not about wagging your finger at yourself, saying you're at fault for everything and everybody else is innocent. Sometimes other people, in fact, are to blame. There are things that happen that are other people's fault. And practically speaking, there are times when we do need to assign blame and when we might need to say, in this case, I have to point the finger at you and do something about that. But the most important thing is that we take responsibility for our own state of mind and our own practice. No one else can be responsible for our heart, our human heart. And that is so empowering to realize that. And I think that is the real meaning of this slogan. It really means take responsibility for the condition of your own heart, even when you have been oppressed by other people. And that may be a reality, and you may need to do actions to overcome that oppression. Even in those conditions, realize that at bottom you are always free and always responsible. And have always been, even when you've been oppressed. So it doesn't obviate the need to overcome oppression and take actions to overcome oppression, but it really speaks to the underlying attitude that we should have as human beings, autonomous, spiritual, conscious human beings. So thank you for bringing that up, because that's a really important point, and it's possible that many other people have the same issue in relation to that slogan. Yeah. David, last word.
You know what, I'll pass.
Oh. Well, it's lunchtime.